So let's just start by asking you what took you to Greenham? What are your first memories? What took you there?
Well, I think I'll start by saying that I was a visitor. I never stayed in the camp.
That's fine.
But what it was, I had not been in the UK for very long. I moved to the UK in the late 70s. And I was living in St. Giles, in quite an isolated area of southwest Cornwall. But we did form quite a strong group of consciousness raising. So we had quite a large group of women of St. Giles that met and discussed feminist issues of the time, really, because, you know, there was at the time, there was the whole kind of debate between liberal and radical feminism, and what is it to be a woman, and all of that kind of stuff. So we had sort of weekly meetings, this particular group, and we had one particular woman, Jenny, who was slightly older than us and whose children were older than us, that took the leadership. Not in a kind of hierarchical way, you know, but she had more time because the rest of us were all quite young mothers. Mm. I was in my 20s and had a small child. So, and also I personally was a member of CND at the time, and I also did some education work for Oxfam. And that meant that I had a lot of contact with Quakers, who made up most of the staff at Oxfam at the time. So all of these things were very much in the air. And then Greenham started, and we decided that we will go and visit. And it was an action, in many ways, it wasn't just about going and supporting Greenham, but I think it was more of a kind of assertion of, as women, we have a right to do this, and the fact that it was all women meant that the men in our lives had to keep the babies, and, you know, we were going to go on our own and do our thing. So we had a minibus and took off, and in the first instance, we were there before Embrace the Base on a visit.
So you were there early?
Early, yeah. So we were there before Embrace the Base because Jenny had connections in Wales.
Mm.
So she knew the people. So, yeah, that was the first instance. And then we also went for Embrace the Base.
Brilliant.
And then we had a couple of subsequent visits.
And what are your first impressions of that first trip, I suppose, first off, when you first arrived?
I think I probably had quite a different take on it than other people, because the thing is, my own background, you know, I had grown up in a dictatorship, like seriously, so, and a very violent environment, and a particularly violent environment for women, so that women growing up in Spain at the time was very much, you know, you grow up to be submissive, you grow up to be a wife, this is what you do. And so escaping that had been quite a traumatic thing.
Mm.
And consequently, I always felt slightly other.
Yeah.
I felt other, and I felt as
from other women as well.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. I'm guessing the majority of the women who were in the group, the St. Giles group, although the group, you know, although we were all in sort of fairly alternative lifestyles, they were very middle class.
Mm.
And I think this was the cathartic thing for me in Greenham, because I never felt able to talk about what had happened to me and my family to these people, you know. Mm. I just thought, this is beyond your comprehension.
Mm.
So arriving at Greenham, I think, gave me a perspective on a history of violence and a history of aggression. Mm. And the base itself felt very much a violent and aggressive place.
Mm.
The women, I thought, were extremely courageous.
Mm.
I personally had experience of police brutality and in demonstrations and so on. So I wasn't like shocked.
Right.
I was a little bit shocked because I had chosen to come to the UK on the strength that the police didn't carry guns. Mm. I thought that policing here was of a different kind.
Mm.
And I, you know, I had spent my whole life afraid, terrified of the police. Whereas I just thought, in this country, it's not like that. And then I thought, actually, it is like that.
Mm. When it in comes the right to circumstances.
It, in those circumstances, it is like that.
Gosh, that's interesting, isn't it? And did you find other women at Greenham that you could bond with about that, or at least share that experience in a way that you hadn't been able to, perhaps?
I think what happened, and because it's taken me a long time to be able to deal with, you know, in effect, I come from a family of survivors, you know, most of my family were assassinated. Oh, and my aunt is a very notorious case because she was, I mean, this is before I was born. This happened during the Civil War that then occasioned the dictatorship. But my aunt was married to a very famous anarchist writer and was herself kind of very avant-garde woman, feminist, had left her, the family, worked independently, and actually refused to marry by the church and all of that kind of thing. Had two little tiny children, one was 2 and one was months old, and she was arrested with the children, and within 2 weeks they shot her, and the children were taken away to America, and etc. etc. Well, her brothers were all shot as well. So all of that story. Then my mother was put in prison, from being 17 to being nearly 25 before she became a mother.
Yeah.
So all that history, you know, it's like being a Holocaust survivor in a way.
Yeah.
No, not me personally, but you know, the secondary memory.
Mm.
So all of those things, which I'm absolutely happy to discuss. I mean, I've conferenced about it, I've written a book about it, that's all sort of out there now. But at the time, I felt very silenced with all of that. I just didn't think people could cope with it. But what did happen, which was truly amazing and cathartic, is that I could make artworks on the fence about this. And so that's what I did. So, you know, I kind of saw the fence as a continuum of women's physical, tangible expressions of a desire for a different world, a mourning for particular things, and all of that, and so that's what I did. I made little installations on the fence.
Wow. What sorts of things did you make?
Well, I just used photographs and bits of, you know, material that was relevant to me, and ribbons and vegetable matter and what have you, but which probably people couldn't, although I did write where it was. But I just thought, for those who can read, they'll read. But for those who can't, they won't. And it's fine. Yeah. It's my own particular sort of monument.
Yeah.
As it were, you know. Yeah. And it's interesting because I felt that even though I wasn't expressing this to anybody other than in this form, I felt that I had done it. I felt that I had expressed it. So that was a big step. So that was one element of it that was really powerful for me. There were other things that were related to being a young mother and the effect of this awareness of the impending possibility of nuclear. Because we march in all the Maston as well, and even at St Morgan we had.
Oh really?
Yeah, you know, the base here.
Yes, I do. I've also protested.
Yes, and we might have been there at the same time, and you know, and used to do all the thing at the bottom of Causeway Head in Penzance every week, full on sort of on that. But
yeah,
I think that the, you know, you're anxious when you have young children, and And I remember having this vision. I remember having this vision, which was to do with the endless threat of the nuclear thing, which I somehow entwined with the idea of a lineage that I was thinking, because I was thinking, well, maybe it won't happen in my lifetime, but it doesn't happen in my lifetime, it'll happen on his lifetime, and if not that, then the grandchild. And and sort of had like this vision of time, huge amounts of time, where whatever we did now will have an impact on that. And it became kind of frightening, but important as well. Yeah. Yes.
I was just thinking about... That makes complete sense. I was just thinking back about the when you were talking about the fence as well. Was there anyone that interacted with you on either side of the fence about what you were doing? Either on the military side or on the Greenham side?
Well, there was quite a lot of rattling of the fence whilst one was trying to... from the other side.
Were they trying to put you off?
Yeah.
Really? Yes. How childish of them.
I know. I think maybe because quite a lot of the people who were putting things on the fence were just like going and tying something up. I was like sort of on
it.
For a while. And they didn't so like that. The other thing that was really interesting is that my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law, who lived in Surrey, I gave them a call and said, I'm coming up to Greenham, and they both turned up.
Oh, how lovely.
Yeah, so, and very middle-class women, very middle-class women, and they both turned up. And so I met with them there as well. I don't know how, because it was just like such a, I think we managed somehow to arranged to meet at the gate or something.
Because it's all before mobile phones or anything, isn't it? It's
completely. It was like landline and notes. But we did manage to meet. And I had, so that for me was also like a really interesting bonding thing with women who were my political family, but you know, that I had always found quite different in lifestyle from my own.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was great, and that was a bond. A further bond that was across, because...
Had you not expected them to come? Had you expected them to maybe be shocked or...?
I didn't think my mother-in-law would be shocked, because she, both herself and my father-in-law, were very Labourite. They're probably the only Labour people in the village.
Yes,
So
probably just them and my parents.
So I did think that she would come, although her lifestyle was much more... But I didn't think my sister-in-law would ever come.
Oh, really?
No. That was like a complete wow, you know. And I thought that was... Do you know, like, you get in your little cultural ghettos, you know, like, we live this lifestyle and they're sort of straight and, and much more when we were younger. And it was... I found that more interesting, the cutting across the class and sort of lifestyle thing. I found that more interesting and more relevant than hanging out with people who are already new thought like me.
Yeah. And do you think...
Strangely,
No, that makes complete sense to me. And I'm interested that you bring that up, because one of the ways I think that Greenham is quite often dismissed now, particularly amongst kind of academics, is that for being sort of white feminism... or basically not very representative of, and actually being very middle class. But I found in our interview process, women from all different backgrounds, I mean, really, really broad, and in a sense, having the first experience of, in a very meaningful way, intersectional feminism happening at Greenham.
I think intersectional feminism was happening at Greenham. I can't say that I saw any black women there, but then I was only there 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
So I don't know how that went. And also, I think with the intersectionality, it's really interesting, because I think that particular moment, you know, late 70s, early 80s, is when actually black women are reacting to feminism, you know. So they're just saying, you ain't speaking for me, sister. So I think that might have had something to do with it. But I certainly wasn't British middle class. And there were, I'm sure, lots of other women. I mean, the Welsh women, for goodness sake, a lot of them they didn't come from middle class backgrounds, and certainly not. I mean, the person who we were most grateful to for organizing us, you know, and hiring the minibus and taking us there, certainly came from very, very working class background. And she actually is still she's gay, and. So her partner was there as well, but so were the multitude of foster children from all kind of, you know, they fostered 5 or 6 children, actually, in St. Jas, who came from, like, really difficult, tricky.
Yeah.
They were all there.
And they took them to Greenham?
Oh, yeah. They all came. I mean, they were much older than I was. So the kids were like 15, 16. They were all there.
Still an amazing thing to have in your growing up bag of tricks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it was an extraordinary thing. Just in terms of, well, embracing the base was incredible.
Tell us a bit about that.
You just...
For someone listening who might not know what it was, to give us a bit
so
of a description.
So the base is huge. I think there were maybe 12,000 women, maybe more. I don't have the figures.
I think it's even bigger.
It's maybe 20,000
women.
Yeah,
I think it's pushing up that way, definitely.
Because it was huge, this place was absolutely huge. And I remember also, so I remember arriving there. It's very different geography from Como, you know, so... Mm. There were trees, and there was a lot of mud, like really a lot. I mean, in a sense, we were better prepared because we came from Cornwall and, you know, so
yeah.
Had the kit. But yeah, so there was that, and there was a lot of milling around and people singing and all of that kind of thing. And then the moment came, and everybody came up to the thing, and you held hands, and suddenly there was like this total consciousness, you know, of this is huge, and everybody's, and we've done it, you know, we have, because there were people running as well, you know, like,
so sending messages,
passing messages and all of that kind of thing, so you knew that it had happened, it was complete.
And that was all women, wasn't it, embrace the
That
place?
Was all women. I know that men were there, but I never saw any.
Okay.
Because I think the men were in a kind of servicing. From what I understood at the time, the women were doing all the active stuff and everything, and men could make dinner or the tea or, you know, just like the things that you would normally associate with a woman. That in itself, I think, was quite an extraordinary thing for a lot of people, you know, to see that that was possible. Because I think it's difficult for women, although I know that sexism is all there and continues and all the rest of it, it's a very different world now. And at the time, even though we came from, certainly our group, even though we came from sort of alternative lifestyles, they weren't that alternative. All the women were at home baking the bread and looking after the children, you know, that's what it was. The men were all, because, you know, there's also that particular, I thought that myself, you know, coming from where I came from, and when I saw how people were living their lives in what was like a sort of post-hippie a set of communities, I thought this is actually worse.
Really?
Yeah, because the women are kept under control by this, well, you're uncool if you don't do this, you know, we men are free and we do, and it was quite an oppressive, there's a lot of domestic violence.
Really?
These are really,
yeah,
domestic violence. There was, for instance, I mean, I think my partner was the only one who never used to go to the pub to get drunk with the others, because he used to say, if you can't go, I'm not going. But all the men would just come back from work, troop out, go to the pub, get pissed, come back.
Right.
And this was like apparently enlightened.
This is the left wing sort of men. Yeah, that leaves you nowhere to go, does it?
Exactly. So that... And so that's why the awareness groups were so necessary. They were so necessary. And then Greenland provided a model.
Yeah.
For autonomy.
Yeah.
Really. For you don't have to depend on a man to do this. You can just go and do it. Which I thought was great.
Yeah.
There were aspects of the Greenland way that I ideologically had trouble with.
Oh, okay. Tell us about that. More about that.
And I think that the because I've always been a feminist. You know, my mother was a feminist, and I've always, but I guess I've also grappled with it intellectually,
mm-hmm.
and I think one of the things that I found tricky,
mm-hmm.
although I could see that strategically it made sense, was this association of women with biologically determined way of being. So the determinism I wasn't so keen on.
Yeah.
This idea that somehow we're closer to nature, or, you know, we're more sort of peaceable beings. Or
yes. Like it wasn't in our nature to be angry or warlike.
Culturally, I totally understand that that's what we were doing, you know.
Yeah.
Culturally, we were. Obviously.
But there's a difference between the nature and the nurture of that, isn't
exactly,
there?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Which now is much more fluid, but at the time it seemed to be like those two arguments were either or. And that side of it, I was always a little bit like, I don't know about that.
Why do you think you had those reservations about it?
I think that is possible because I have always come from a very academic way of thinking. I'm very analytical, and I used to read stuff. So, you know, I was quite well up on feminist theory at the time, reading and the debates that were going on. And I just thought, no. I don't
think it's innate. Were you thinking, I'm not sure it's innate?
I was thinking, not only am I not sure it's innate, but also I want more freedom than this.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, I want more scope.
Yeah. I've not jumped out of one box to get in another box.
Exactly.
Sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I also, I guess that, although I saw the value of it, this is going to sound terrible, but although I saw the value and the strategic value of it, I was never a chanter or a singing.
Oh, okay. Because singing is such a huge part of Greenland as well,
isn't it? It's a huge part, and I could totally get it, but I never felt it myself. I never felt it.
That's interesting, considering that you had that really cathartic experience with a more practical textile art.
Yeah.
So what do you think that... I suppose, do you know why you felt differently about them?
I don't know. I.
Why did they land differently to you, I suppose?
I think I didn't like the socks. That sounds awful, doesn't it?
Cool.
I think
they're very much of a style.
They're very much of a style, yeah. I didn't like the socks. I was always totally respectful of the whole thing. I just thought, whatever you have to do, you have to do. But I'm also, I think the thing I'm trying to kind of formulate in my head, there is something about, there is a, and I see this with friends I have that are coming from, you know, bad situations in Syria and elsewhere.
Mm.
There is a sense, when you come with a trauma like that into a situation, that you just look at people and think, you like children.
Yeah, sure.
You are just like children.
Mm.
I don't see it like that now.
No.
I really don't at all. But at the time, and I was young, at the time I used to look around and say, I want to be part of this, but actually...
This feels juvenile. Yeah.
It wasn't.
No.
I totally realized now at my older age that it wasn't doing that, and I kept going and I went to everything, but there was a sense of separateness always.
Did you, because I know that, and I think possibly because you were a visitor and maybe you didn't cross paths with it, but there were people, women that went to escape domestic violence or to come out of prison because there wasn't places that they felt they could be safely in an all-female environment and things.
Yeah.
So there might well have been other women feeling the same way as you in a way, from different sorts of trauma.
Because I think there
were all, you don't know that when you're all together, do you?
You don't know that. And also, you know, the kind of the eye of a 23-year-old is jaundiced.
Yeah.
We're not that clever at that age. We haven't had much life experience. Do you know what I mean?
But also, both things can be true at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, you did have very unique, very, you know, very damaging, dramatic, heightened experiences.
And yet...
This is very separating from the people that you've been around.
Exactly, but I think at the same time, you know, in when you look at it in retrospect and not through the egotism of being a young person, you realise that actually I had been through all of that and I had suffered violence from the police, but I never suffered violence from a partner. Mm. That's a lot worse. That's a lot worse.
Equally terrible. And
you know,
different.
You can't escape that.
No.
You can't hide anywhere.
Mm.
So you know, I'm totally aware of where a lot of these women were coming from as well. And, yeah. And also the experience, I think that, for me, I always associate, I don't know why, but I always associate the experience of Greenham with the experience of motherhood.
That's interesting.
Really strongly, you know, because it's almost like now I'm responsible for this now.
Yeah.
That aspect of it is, I think, mobilise a lot of people. You know.
Yeah, I think so too. And one of the things that we hear a lot from people who were with a partner, when you talk to women who are with a male partner, really often what comes up in the interviews is, I think it's the most common phrase we hear really often is, of course, I'm not with him now.
Oh, and I
something
am.
About really... Well, I was going to say how it sounds like your partner was much more supportive.
He was
the
totally
ones that
supportive.
Hung in there were the ones that were... So how did you find that male's support?
He was totally supportive of me.
That's great.
I mean, that doesn't mean that we didn't have issues to resolve.
Of course.
At the time. But in terms of everything that I have ever done that took me away from the home, and I've done plenty that took me away from the home, he's always been super supportive.
That's great. Would you say that's reflective of the men in your life in general? Or
no.
No.
No, I wouldn't say that.
Mm.
I wouldn't say that. For a lot of the women who came along, it was difficult and it caused a lot of arguments later on. It caused separations.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it caused for people to either feel further oppressed or decide I'm not putting up with this. And I mean, I guess I was lucky, or I don't know, you know, some people just are lucky in
sounds like you picked well too, which is really great.
So I wouldn't have stayed
if
I hadn't had the freedom to do what I needed to do.
Mm.
But I think it's another thing about that background, you know, because my mother was who she was, and she'd been through everything that she'd been through, and she was kind of a feminist avant la lettre, even though, because she was forbidden, you know, when she came out of prison, super intelligent woman, coming from a really sort of cultured background, not allowed to study, not allowed to work, not allowed to do absolutely anything, and just to get married and have children. I mean, my dad was a perfectly nice man, but, you know, she was unable to... So everything was focused on us, and very particularly on me, actually, because I was a female child.
Yeah.
So she pushed me a lot. You know, she, in fact, told me to leave the country.
Really?
Yeah, she did. She said, you know, this is not going to work for you at all. And very much warned me about men and warned me a lot about what you present to men and to always be a serious person that's the front you present rather than like flirty. I've never been able to flirt in my life after all that. You
nothing
know,
that
let
unfunny jokes, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
No matter how unfunny you are, I'm going to laugh, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that might have had something to do with the fact that we created quite an equal relationship earlier on. You know, that was, it wasn't a surprise.
No.
It wasn't a surprise. But anyway, yes, amongst the group that we were going with, it was a serious issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm really interested that, like, obviously there are lots of exceptions, but quite a lot of the people, particularly the people who were perhaps the more casual visitors, well, that one was really casual, but, you know, the people that visited rather than, say, lived there, mostly it's primarily a fear of the bomb or an awareness of the work of CND, and then they get there and they're radicalised by the feminism. But it feels like with you it was almost the other way around. It was on your radar straight away, as a potentially
as a feminist action, yeah. Absolutely, it was a feminist action.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what do you think the significance of it being women only? Did you see the significance of it at the time? Is that why you were interested in it?
I was totally interested in that because I was observing so much of the... This is the thing that I found so shocking, you know. I knew about macho men and all of that, where it was institutionalised in Spain, you know. But when I came... I had my head filled, you know, with these alternative ways of living where people are freer, where this, you know, is marvellous. And then I actually seen how these people lived, Rebecca. It was more oppressive because it was disrespectful, you know.
And
it
dishonest. Wasn't
just, it was dishonest behaviour by these men, a lot of these men. Really awful. And for me... And it took me a couple of years to actually realise what I was seeing around me. You know, it was bad. And I think that that is where I thought. And also, you know, this thing that you find in any situation, who's doing the speaking? The man is doing the speaking. Who's doing the deciding? The man is doing the deciding. And I just thought, fantastic, get rid of the men. You know, for an action.
Yeah.
For something that you are actually... Get rid of them, because I knew at the time, or I think I knew at the time, I don't know whether this is a memory reconstruction, but I think I knew at the time that if men came round, they'll end up leading it. They'll do it, you know.
Yeah.
I remember talking to the men behind.
The men on the men on the base?
Yeah. Yeah, talking to them, I said, oh, you shouldn't be doing that job. And
what did they say?
They were very silent.
Really?
Yeah, the ones I spoke to were very silent. I mean, I'm sure that for the people who camped and stayed there, they had a closer set of encounters, but, yeah.
So you would try and talk to them and they would just try and stay professional, as it
professional,
were, in inverted commas.
Professional,
yeah.
Yes, completely professional. It felt very much also as if the world beyond the gate was completely another world. And
really?
It felt... It has informed in work that I've done subsequently, you know, but part of the sensation that I had there is informed, like, versions of the underworld that I've worked on. Yeah, very much, because it felt liminal, that place, you know. The fence was properly liminal.
Yeah.
Outside, there was one thing, and inside there was
something completely
different. And then returning there... As we did last year, there are areas that still feel really like that. You know, I mean, nature, I know nature has recovered a lot of it. The traces are old. I mean, you've been there, you know.
Yeah.
The silos still feel very frightening.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it's quite strange to go. There's little bits of blue gate and things left, isn't there? Just little, like, just little traces of wool and a bit of graffiti and...
Yeah.
And it's... It is very interesting.
Yeah.
What did you feel going back and seeing those things in terms of, did you feel like society had changed, or was it changing and staying the same at the same time?
I felt like a piece of history, because I'm the oldest in the company, but Sue was the same age as me, but she wasn't there. And so when we got there, and people hadn't made the connection, because we were just going for that, and I was saying, I was here in 83, and I was here.
Yeah,
and everybody was like, what? So I felt like a bit of a piece of history, even though I was so marginal to it, you know, I certainly wasn't in any way. But I felt that, and then I felt, to be honest, I felt there were more innocent days. then. I think it's much worse now.
Yeah. It's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm. It's a weird thing. It's a weird thing when you think, actually, Heseltine maybe wasn't so bad.
God, that's terrible.
That. It's awful, isn't it?
Isn't
that awful?
Yes.
Well, it, comparatively, I mean.
Yeah. I'm following Ken Clark on Twitter, thinking, you say it, Ken. Oh, God, no.
I know.
I didn't support Ken Clark.
I know. Yeah. That's the awful thing.
It's really strange.
That it has got so very much worse. And also that some of the apparent benefits of not just Greenham, but generally, because I think Greenham, in terms of the feminist agenda, they were really vilified.
Mm.
You know,
absolutely.
Really vilified, which was dreadful.
Mm.
But in terms of the feminist agenda, I thought that they had, you know, that things had started to happen and there was more respect and all of that. But actually, it was a veneer.
Mm.
It's all back.
Yeah. It's very hard to look at Boris and Trump, who are such openly abusive people of women and people of colour and so on, and not think, we haven't gone anywhere. Or we need whatever we had back, or whatever it is. But
I think that what it uncovers is that these guys, like Boris and Trump, what they do is they give permission to all these large, vast swathes of people who
yeah.
have been holding back all
yes.
this time. And now they're finally free
yes.
to do the same thing
to say
again.
The same things and do the same
yeah,
things.
So yeah, so it is... Well, one hopes that, you know, particularly with, I mean, although I know Me Too is all about celebrity and so on, but no, that, you know, that women perhaps now feel more empowered to respond.
Mm.
That is the one hope.
Yeah, absolutely.
That I hang on to, really. And that also I think that we have become very much more well-informed.
Yeah.
And there's a hell of a lot of really amazing women out there writing and doing stuff. And
yeah, absolutely.
And that, I think, is great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about the fact that you were saying, you know, you in the group, I mean, this happens to me all the time as well. I quite often, if I speak to anyone who's younger than me, No, they know nothing about Greenham. Not just,
no.
Oh, were you or weren't you there? But just, they've never even heard of it. Which I think for such a successful, arguably, but certainly such an impactive piece of fairly recent history.
Mm.
In fact, not even in some ways history, in some ways it's still kind of carrying on. And as we're talking about, the issues are still hugely relevant. The women are still active.
Yeah.
All that stuff. Why has it vanished so completely? Why do you think it hasn't in any way been handed on? Why is that absence there in that knowledge, do you think?
I think it was probably too difficult for people to deal in so many ways.
Mm.
Too difficult to accept. One, because the women proved themselves to be powerful.
Mm-hmm.
This is a no-no, as you
yeah.
know. Because there was alternative.
Mm.
You know, they were nice people.
Yeah.
So that was really, definitely because they were women only.
Mm.
This is unpalatable to a
yeah.
lot of people. Although I always saw it as a strategic thing.
Yeah.
You know, it was a strategy. It wasn't saying, and
yes.
there's this
wasn't the final
tremendous fear.
The
there's this tremendous, I see with my students here, this tremendous fear that if you call yourself feminist, you're a man hater.
Yeah.
And they all go, you know, and they just don't understand the strategies, the gender strategies that
mm.
we have to adopt.
Yeah.
And, I mean, so we do have some nice little core groups of young women here who are
mm.
quite different, but because that's the other aspect that in my view, working with young people is, we're going downhill, really,
mm.
on this thing about self-presentation, representations of femininity,
mm.
And all of that shit.
Yeah.
You know, it's bad.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
It
concludes in very dangerous stereotypes as well, doesn't it? Yeah, about what is female and what is male or what is man.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And equally, there's great advances in the, you know, GLBT and all of that, and but the current ideal of femininity
yeah.
is very, very toxic.
Yes. Feels like the sort of stuff I've been trying to decode and not collude with, because it's essentially very attractive shackles. And it's, yeah.
But I'm guessing, and that's not a reason why people wouldn't have passed on the inheritance of freedom. I am, I'm sort of kind of appalled as well at the lack of historical awareness that young people have.
Why do you think that is?
It's not just.
No, not just Greenham.
It's everything. It's absolutely everything. They don't know who Margaret Thatcher was.
That's so recent too, isn't it? You don't get this government without Margaret Thatcher, do you?
Exactly.
We're not very good at putting in the links, are we? We teach everything in isolation, I think.
Exactly. So trying to give them a timeline. I try to do that with students here, you know, trying to just say, look, you know, we didn't get this kind of neoliberal...
Mm.
capitalist craziness out of the blue. It all started there, and this is the effects it had, you know, and sort of and also kind of looking at artists that have explored all of these things. But Greenham is a massive omission in the history of women, actually.
Yeah. And the LGBT. Yeah, history as well.
Absolutely.
A huge omission. And anyone who misses it is a missing, you know, quite massive swathes of our gay and lesbian heritage.
Yeah.
Recent, like, living experience.
Very recent heritage, yeah. Exactly. I don't even know what's going on at academic levels with that.
No, it's very peculiar, isn't it? Whether
there's any studies being done.
It doesn't seem to have been meaningfully kept in the mainstream, either academically or in the media or culturally. I don't know if that will change next year's big anniversary. It might pop again for a while, who knows?
It might well do. When we were at Greenham ourselves, my friend who teaches at Goldsmiths, she came to do a talk. She works in kind of interspecies stuff, which is like this new kind of brand of thinking about people and animals, really. Mm. But, you know, she's GLBD. She's, you know, do you know the work of people like Donna Haraway? And
no, I don't.
Okay, well, it's really interesting. Really interesting. Anyway, Helen came down. Helen is herself gay. And came to talk to us about her work.
Mm.
But was totally amazed that we were at Greenham. And we went for a walk together, and she certainly knew everything, and she's quite young, Helen. Mm. She knew everything about it and thought it was amazing.
Great.
And being there, you know, was really interested in the terrain and taking photographs and all of that. But I don't see it reflected in media or in...
No, which is peculiar, because I'm doing a lot of sharing these things, and I'm finding that almost every single person you lay the idea of Greenham in front of is fascinated by it.
Mm.
And if they've never heard of it, they feel like it's cultural robbery that they have never heard of it.
Well, true.
Which is true.
It's absolutely true.
And this is people from, you know, we just literally did a schools workshop on Tuesday with 8-year-olds who absolutely loved it and were making their own protest banners, by the end of it singing their own protest songs.
It's such an incredible narrative.
Amazing. And like you say, it makes you go, oh, we could do things. We could do other things. Mm. Another world is possible.
Yes.
You know.
Exactly. It's empowering for women. It's a tremendous piece. I mean, I would equate the Greenham moment with the suffragettes, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
Personally. Because it was like a proper movement of women, you know, and even though the groups that were able to stay there or were determined to stay there were smaller, the moments when people turned up en masse, that was spectacular.
Mm.
It was spectacular, really. You know, as an action.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it changed things for you going forward?
It did change things for me. It changed things for me in the sense that it gave me courage to think that this was possible.
Mm.
It made me a very curious thing that has endured with me is that it made me realize that it was possible to really communicate and share things with people across different cultures.
Mm.
And by that I mean, you know, like, when you come out of a situation and you're totally anti-religious and not really, you know, it's all absolutely, and then you realize actually these Quaker people, they are amazing. They're brave and, you know, and these other people, and it's taught me not to ever, ever prejudge anybody.
That's interesting. Wow.
Which is really good because for the work I do with Wild Works, it does mean that I have to speak to anybody. So, so for instance, when we were working a couple of years ago, creating the show for Heligan, Unearth, and the research I was doing for that, because I was lead artist on that, and I really wanted to for the thing not to just be about the First World War. So the First World War was going to be a beginning, but we were playing with the idea the war to end all wars. Hello.
Yeah.
Hello. So I wanted all the contemporary into that. So I went and talked to a lot of veterans.
Yeah.
And I felt sort of slightly odd, you know, going to interview these people. But I reminded myself of that thing. You never know. You just never, ever know. And actually, I interviewed all these guys. And pretty well to a man, they said that the commanders were war criminals, and they had been made to do things that were entirely unacceptable.
Gosh,
it was quite extraordinary, and quite graphically explaining what these things had been.
Gosh,
so that the majority, so that then you start. This is what I mean, you know. So I asked them why they join and all of that. Majority of them joined because they went accepted at college. Because they didn't have a job, they wanted to learn to fly a plane, they wanted to become, they wanted to work for National Health in time and start as paramedics and all of that kind of thing, you know, in a country at peace that hadn't seen any conflict for a long time. And so these are the guys, some of them are going to the Falklands, and then some of them had been bombing Iraq. And yeah, it was extraordinary what they were saying, you know. And I was thinking, in fact, I was reflecting on that afterwards and just thinking, I learned a lot about this non-prejudicial attitude as an outcome of Green Amman campaigning at the time.
That's really great.
Yeah.
And did you... I mean, obviously, the big thing with Greenham is the Carrie Greenham home thing. You know, you take it back. Did you do anything like that? Did it come back with you? Did you do anything?
Well, we did a lot of dissemination of what had happened to other groups. We also made, at the Acorn, we had, I organised a season of films called Women on War.
Oh, great.
We had you know, like Rosie the Riveter and all of the typical stuff of the time. And one of the films was Caravan of Peace, which was Dora Russell led a caravan into Russia, into the Soviet Union.
Oh, wow.
The Caravan of Peace. So she came to present. She was very elderly at the time. And she came to present it. And lo and behold, there's a guy... There's a guy who is, I think he's dead now, but Polish, who was a leather worker and a bit of a hippie, and he turned up and he shouted at her. Like, it was awful. Because obviously Poland, you know, the time was under the Soviet Union, she really made a beef about it. But this wasn't about that, this was about these women. You know, Caravan of Peace was an action to join women together across the divide.
Not to promote the Soviet Union.
No. I mean, Dora was a communist. She never hid that she was, but you know. Anyway.
There are lots of communists that are critical of the Soviet Union.
So that's one of the things that we did. That was great. And then out of that, out of the Women on War film season, another subgroup came together that were making films.
Oh, lovely.
Women filmmakers. There was quite a lot of sort of that kind of stuff going on, you know. I mean, for me, I've always been more of a... Because I'm an artist. I do art things, you know.
That makes sense then. And you said it came into your work, didn't it?
Yeah.
In various ways.
Yeah, I make art things, so I'm much more likely to put on a film season than...
Yes.
Call a public meeting.
Do a diet or whatever.
Yeah. and yes, and also, I mean, I guess the other thing I would say is that Jenny, who kind of got us there, Jenny was such an amazing influence in women, and I think that that's quite interesting, you know, some women that are like, totally inspirational and embracing and kind and give you the courage and the wherewithal to go and do things. And I think that that must have been the case in quite a lot of places.
Yeah.
Because it's not so easy to mobilise.
No.
It's not so easy to leave Cornwall when you have young children and you have to get to Greenham that's really out of the way and it's crazy and there's thousands of people. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
Need someone who's just like, yeah, we can do this. We can do it.
I'll book the minivan.
Yeah.
That's it. And having Greenham is a great focal point for suddenly women like that and the women around them to have something to work towards in that way.
Exactly. And I think that it gave life to the groups. It made them more political.
Yeah.
You know, the consciousness raising groups where there was a lot of, before that, there was a lot of grumbling about husbands, which is necessary and great, but quite parochial.
Yeah.
And I think with the consciousness raising groups of the time, it gave a bigger horizon and a more politicized attitude. Yeah.
And I guess it was a chance to try stuff out, like you say, to actually go, well, what would it be like to live without men? Not just theoretically, but I might actually go and stay at Greenham for a day or a weekend or a year and actually find out whether I like that or not.
Yes, yes.
Whether I'm capable of that or not.
Yeah. And there was the capability thing was also, you know, for people to live in that way.
Mm.
It's just so amazing to think that that's possible, isn't it?
Yeah.
That you can make your own fire and prepare your own food and make a shelter out of just some shit. And it's just... It's good, isn't it, for women? Because I think we've been so restricted. I mean, we.
Yes.
So restricted and domesticized.
Mm.
That I did like that. I did like the feral aspect of it. That it was feral, you know.
Yeah.
That they weren't amenable or particularly friendly.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you not find it very friendly?
You know, in the general, I think that the times that we went, I think that there was definitely this also this thing between you're a visitor and you're a resident.
Right, okay.
Which is fair enough.
Yeah.
And the residents weren't the most friendly.
No.
They were quite, but I like that because I think that it's really good for women to be feisty and annoyed. You know.
And not have to be being a nice person all the time.
And not have to be nice and acquiescent and all of that. So I enjoy that aspect of it. I thought they were like proper wild women here.
And it sort of models that you can survive someone not being acquiescent and nice and it doesn't kill you. And it doesn't kill them.
Exactly.
You know?
Or that you can simply survive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without men. I mean survive.
Yeah.
As in hands-on survive.
Back to the basics sort of thing.
I really thought that was great. It was a model, you know. Mm. It was a model for possible ways of being that were other.
Mm.
Yeah.
What do you think the equivalent thing would be now? What would we be discovering if we did something like that now? Is there still those discoveries to make, do you think? Would it be impossible to do now, even?
I think there should be a female... brand of Extinction Rebellion.
Yes, that would be good, isn't it?
I do. I think that would be great.
Mm.
Just simply from the perspective of agency, you know, and being able to have a voice. I know that it's pretty equal, Extinction Rebellion, but there is something that's so ingrained about men always, like... They say that women are chatty, but you know, all those experiments that they did...
Yeah. Yeah.
They never stop talking.
Yeah.
Shocking.
And women will give up space quicker than men will give up space.
Exactly.
I think, in general, in...
Exactly.
In all the times I've ever hosted talks, even when there's only a few men in the room because it's a feminist issue, that men find it much easier to put up their hands and occupy space.
Completely. Absolutely. And, yeah. So it would be really good to you know, or more of a... Yeah, for people... I mean, I've sort of... There's so many women that are, like, educated and powerful and vocal and strong and all of that, but I also see quite a lot of nimbiness out there, quite a lot of...
The pressure is still huge, isn't it? Actually, to not literally physically be as slim, take up as little space as you can.
No.
You know, all that stuff. It's still so present. Which is so 70s and so Victorian and so on.
I had a student the other day saying to me that she takes an hour and a half every morning getting dressed to see what feels slimmer.
Gosh, really? An hour and a half?
An hour and a half. And then she showed me things online where they do rituals to become slimmer. They light candles.
Oh, my God.
I know. And I just looked at her and I said, listen, women need to take more space in the world.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm just telling you now that the only way to be slimmer is to eat less. And you don't need to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
And so, the full circle of that is don't eat anything, die and take up no space.
Exactly.
What a message.
This is just ridiculous. Yeah. There's still, but I didn't know about these sites. Mm. There's all sorts of sites on the internet that say if you do this and the other, you'll be slimmer. And there's like some magic.
Of course.
I know.
All the things you could do as a white witch, what a shame it comes down to that again.
It's boiled down to that again.
Yeah, again. Yeah.
I know, it's really bad.
But if the pressure wasn't so high, you know, they wouldn't advertise if it didn't work. You know, it's...
I know, yeah. I know. It's bizarre. That was just, I don't know, you know, because I come from the second wave and it's such a long time ago. And to see this, I'm really interested, having kind of parking that to one side, all the concerns and worries about all of that. I am at the same time really interested in some how very young women are kind of reframing feminism as well. I think it's great.
Yeah. Do you feel they're reclaiming it or?
Yeah. They're remaking it for themselves, really.
Okay.
I think.
That's interesting.
It's a different world.
Do you still feel they're able to put liberation at the heart of that rather than just equality?
I think
I was very aware in the third wave, it was very much about losing the idea of liberation in the second wave it had. I don't know what you're seeing now.
This is so anecdotal.
That's okay. That's
I have a sense that the way that this is taking place is by is queering.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the queering of people that are just deciding I won't have anything to do with it, I just have my life with another woman.
Right, okay.
I'm seeing a lot of that.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. Which is great.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that this... I've seen an increase.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Massive increase.
So almost... So basically sort of taking a step away from a kind of heteronormative...
Yeah.
Assumption of heteronormality being for you.
Exactly.
Going, maybe it's not. Maybe I could do this other thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Interesting.
And seeing it as well with young people, and not so young people who... started like thinking they were heterosexual and changing inclination, which I think is great, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what I see is that line between like male and female is being considerably blurred, which is quite good.
Mm.
To have a lot more, I mean, here we have a lot more trans young people, yeah. like a lot more.
Yeah. Especially, yeah. I guess, at the art school as well, as part of that, this community.
Okay, more, hopefully more, because of that.
Maybe, more, I don't know, yeah. more expecting, more accepting, more expressive, maybe, I don't know. But more yeah. LGBT friendly, I feel. Mm, more of yeah. a tradition of that in the arts.
Maybe that's why.
I mean, it's not new in the arts, is it? For,
no,
for
no.
people to be basically, essentially, the gender non questioning the gender non-binary.
I'm qualifying as anecdotal because I yeah. am really aware I live in a cultural ghetto, you know. Yeah. It's either in art school or it's in theatre, you
yeah.
know, all of that kind of thing. But it's very noticeable.
Yeah.
That. And some of the articulations of feminism coming from postmodernism, for instance,
yeah.
Are very much about that, are very much about we need to eradicate these binary polarities
mm.
and have a far more kind of blurry and grey
mm.
sort of, which I think, because also this, I think, is not just beneficial for women, but it's beneficial for men, you mm. know, for a lot of men, that mantle that they
yeah.
held is a really heavy burden.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's a heavy burden,
mm.
and it's good to, yeah, it's good for them to shake it.
Mm, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just wonder whether that's an interesting angle, you know, that Greenham, as befitted the time, was so much about polarity.
Yeah.
As was
literally either side of the fence.
Yeah. And I mean men were supportive and some women were not, and
mm,
you know, but
of course.
Overall. But I sort of have a hope for the future that this gender thing is just gonna get a little bit less.
Yeah.
Yeah. Less defining for all of us.
Mm.
Less defining. And yet, I
nice.
Know there's masses of work to be done because
mm.
the statistics speak, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do.
So I'm also aware of this sort of slight ivory tower position.
Is there anything that you thought I might ask you that you wanted me to ask you that I haven't asked or that you feel we
no.
haven't covered?
No, I think it's been really interesting. I mean, I'm sorry that it's sort of so expansive.
No, that's the beauty of it.
My,
it's really interesting.
My experience of actual Greenham was mm. literally 4 visits.
But that's the most amazing, one of the most amazing things about Greenham is that it somehow has this massive impact.
Yeah.
Whether you, even on people who literally, you know, let's say, visited or didn't live there, but it just seems to still change.
Yes.
Something
yeah.
very visceral and core.
Yes, and also
it lasts
I see,
a lifetime.
Having had the opportunity to revisit recently, I did.
Mm.
It made me realise how powerful that had been.
Yeah.
How extraordinarily powerful as an experience. With all the stuff I've told you about, you know, my supporting some things more than others or enjoying
mm.
some things more than others, is that's nothing to do with it. It was the diversity that was also.
Yeah.
For me, the diversity was critical, even if there weren't black people there. Which I'm sure they went
yeah.
for whatever reason.
We have several in the archive that they definitely were, but
yeah,
yeah so
well,
maybe,
that's
but,
good.
But, yeah,
it's great.
Yeah.
To hear
and
about.
Lots of European and international people as well.
European and international
yeah.
people for sure, and
yeah.
and I think that was a really kind of bonding thing for
mm.
women and an expression of power.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
what can be wrong with that?